loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. My co-host, John Kiriakou, is traveling this week. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we focus on Korea. CIA Director Mike Pompeo secretly traveled to the capital of North Korea over the Easter weekend to meet with North Korean head of state Kim Jong-un. Trump will soon meet with his North Korean counterpart, and the two Koreas, North and South Korea, prepare to officially announce a peace agreement. Can the Korean War finally come to an end? And then, in our second segment, we take a look, as we do every Wednesday, on the big issues related to nuclear energy, nuclear technology, and nuclear weapons.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the war in Syria continues to deepen in the wake of last week's U.S.-led missile attack. Saudi Arabia has offered to send ground troops to the country, and controversy continues over the investigation into the alleged chemical weapons attack in Douma. Next, former FBI agent Terry Albury pleaded guilty yesterday to providing secret documents to the press. In a statement, he said he knew it was against the law, but he felt strongly that the public needed to know about the racism inherent in FBI practices. Then, in a surprise move, Turkish President Erdogan has called an early general election scheduled for June 24th. With the government fostering a wave of nationalistic fervor across the country, opposition forces fear that these elections may further consolidate Erdogan's stranglehold on power. And then, the FBI raid targeting Trump lawyer Michael Cohen has put the principle of attorney-client privilege in the spotlight. What could the long-term legal implications be of the precedent set by the Mueller investigation? And finally, Donald Trump is acting as chief salesman for Boeing as he pushes Kuwait to agree to a $10 billion fighter jet purchase. How common is this practice, and what does it say about the U.S. economy and society? And in other headlines, officials from the Departments of Defense and State appeared before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee today to defend the Trump administration's policy of support for the Saudi-led war against Yemen. The war in Yemen has come under increasing international criticism as the dire humanitarian crisis caused by the war leads to widespread death and disease. The United States is Saudi Arabia's main arms supplier and also provides logistical assistance for their efforts in Yemen. In a 51-47 vote today, the Senate repealed guidance issued by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to combat racial discrimination in auto loans. The Senate invoked the Congressional Review Act to strike down the CFPB guidance, which was issued in 2013. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has been the subject of major controversy in recent months as Trump maneuvered to install Office of Management and Budget Director Mick Mulvaney as head of the agency. Former California State Senate head Kevin DeLeon secured an important ally in his bid to unseat incumbent Senator Dianne Feinstein, Tom Steyer, a well-known California billionaire and mega donor to Democratic campaigns. This could signal a windfall of cash for the DeLeon campaign. Miguel Diaz-Canel was formally proposed as a candidate for president in Cuba today. If he is elected, he would replace Raul Castro, who has served as president for 10 years. The National Assembly will vote tomorrow to officially elect Diaz-Canel, a 57-year-old engineer. Those are today's headlines. Next up is a discussion about the possibility of a peace treaty being signed between North and South Korea.
Loud and clear.
But first we turn to Korea. A minister in the government of South Korea has confirmed that a peace treaty with the North is on the agenda for the summit between Moon Jae-in and Kim Jong-un, set for April 27th. What would this historic step mean for the future of the Korean Peninsula and for the Korean people? We are joined from Santa Cruz, California, by Dr. Christine Hong. She is the Associate Professor of Critical Race and Ethnic Studies at UC Santa Cruz and a member of the Korea Policy Institute. And we are joined from Seattle by Simone Chun. She's a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korea Peace Network. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Brian.
Dr. Hong, let's start with you. These are just such historic days for the Korean Peninsula, for the Korean people. When you think back to September, just September of 2017, where you have Donald Trump from the podium at the General Assembly, using that primary diplomatic space to threaten the total annihilation of North Korea. Now there's the possibility of real serious negotiations, and apparently serious negotiations have already started because CIA director and State Department nominee Mike Pompeo was apparently in North Korea meeting with the North Korean leadership. When you think about just the dynamism of the past few months, it's pretty breathtaking.
It really is. I mean, you know, we've been on a wild ride with the Trump administration in terms of his Korea policy. And we're in this moment in which peace seems like a possibility on the horizon. Now, there are major structural obstacles to the realization of peace, and I hope that we can discuss that. But yes, you know, it's true. Donald Trump not only sent Pompeo as a major envoy to sort of lay the groundwork for the possibility of a summit to come, but also stated, you know, in a kind of strange way that he gives his blessing to the possibility of North and South Korea discussing peace. Of course, that doesn't really make sense because if you look at the 1953 Korean War Armistice Agreement, it's not North and South Korea that can conclude peace on their own with the United States from afar giving its blessing. The United States actually actively has to be at the table, and it has to be willing to renegotiate its military presence south of the DMZ in order for peace to be concluded.
Those are important points. And I do want to talk about the structural problems that exist, the hurdles, as you put them. And hopefully we can go over them in detail because they're very important. There's layers of them. And it's important for the audience, which probably isn't like, you know, most people not paying careful attention to what's actually going on and bouncing off the headlines of the corporate-owned media. We want to get sort of in-depth on that. Professor Chun, I want to ask you, because we've talked to you over the past, well, ever since Trump came into office, and we've gone through all these different ups and downs and iterations of what's going to happen, and you had Moon Jae-in coming in initially, and there was such promise and such almost euphoria that things would start to happen, and then it seemed like, well, maybe not, because Donald Trump was being so bellicose in his rhetoric and Moon Jae-in was standing next to him. And it seemed like maybe South Korea was being taken in tow once again by the American government with its own agenda. And yet it really was the Moon Jae-in government and the North Korean government that have created all the momentum that has created a new set of facts. And those facts become the context in which even the American government's diplomacy is taking place. Anyway, your take on the sort of looking backwards and where we are right now.
Yes, this is truly amazing journey. And I think the takeaway of from this latest statement from to Korea's cooperation, that is their willingness, they want to make a political declaration that end the Korean War, is this. To Korea is right now, the inter-Korean cooperation, inter-Korean summit is right now, is, I think it's becoming more in the really truly in the driver's seat. It is becoming, as a Korean scholar pointed out, that the two Koreas right now is an independent variable of the ongoing peace process, not a dependent variable, which means that in the past, you know, any issue that concerned two Koreas or security on the Korean Peninsula was subordinated to the U.S. Security concern. But now I think that this year we have clearly a new paradigm, that is two Koreas right now is taking initiative and for some odd reasons and some probably political reasons, Donald Trump is going along with it. And the statement that actually came up from the White House about Donald Trump's talking about this latest development was actually remarkable. This is the first time, as I recall, the American president had something like, you know, he said, this is, I'm just reading here, says, people don't realize, this is quoting Donald Trump, people don't realize Korean War has not ended. It is going right now. And this is the kind of, you know, that we've been talking about it. So I think the fact that Donald Trump is addressing the, you know, the ongoing, the unending Korean War is good. But I think that is actually a very important point that we have to think. As if you only listen to Donald Trump talking to press, it is as if the two Koreas, the one who is really two Koreas, are the obstacle to the peace, which is not true, as Kristen pointed out, that it is United States that has been consistently being, you know, in a way, in the main player in preventing the permanent peace treaty, etc. So I think we really have to correct the public misconception. Two Koreas have only, even both conservative and progressive, you know, administration, they always have some kind of engagement. And even including this latest, what analysts call the absolutely earth-shaking, meaning the North and South Korea, you know, might talk about the ending Korean War. This is not new, actually. It has been, as you recall, November 4th, there was the second inter-Korean summit meeting declaration. Has precisely the same language, and I will read to you here in the number 4. The South and North share the wish to terminate the existing amnesty regime and to build a permanent peace regime. So what that means is that a couple of things. One is two Korea wants to make the, you know, to have a peace treaty right away will be the, obviously the most desirable outcome, but you need some kind of a transition period. You can't just say, because it's technically war, how can you have a form of peace treaty? So they want to take a step-by-step approach. So what I'm going to see is that they're going to have political declaration of ending the hostilities, and then have followed by a three-way summit, possibly North and South Korea and United States, and or four-way summit, North, South Korea, and China, and then eventually leading to a peace treaty. But get back to your point, and yes, with the biggest takeaway is really two Korea's cooperation is recognized really, really a major variable.
Okay, that's the voice of Professor Simone Chun. She is a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute. She's also a member of the Korean Peace Network. We're also joined from Santa Cruz, California, by Dr. Christine Hong. Christine is the Associate Professor of Critical Race and Ethnic Studies at UC Santa Cruz. You're listening to Loud and Clear. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. if you're in the Washington, D.C. area by listening at 105.5 FM or 1390 AM. You can subscribe to this show as an iTunes podcast. You can also follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio or on Facebook, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker. Christine Hong, I want to talk for a moment, going back to what you alluded to in your first comment. Donald Trump said he, quote, gives his blessings to the possibility of a peace deal between North and South Korea or these negotiations. I mean, it's an oddly colonial formulation. Of course, the North Koreans were not asking for, requesting, requiring, or expecting Donald Trump's blessings in any way. It does, in a way, sort of perhaps as an unintended consequence, demonstrate that the U.S. feels that South Korea has very limited sovereignty, that they have to get the blessings of some foreign government to talk to other Koreans. I mean, it just kind of stands out as a colonial statement. But nonetheless, the practical significance of it is that Trump is for it rather than being against it. Trump is also saying, this is all about me, of course, in Donald Trump fashion. This wouldn't be happening without the United States, and mainly because of me. Again, all that aside, and the world kind of looks at Donald Trump now after, whatever, 15 or 16 months in office and sort of pushes some of that rhetoric aside to look at something else. When we think back, and again, let's just stay in the big picture for a moment. Would Donald Trump, the president of the United States, be going to meet Kim Jong-un if North Korea had not developed nuclear weapons, if North Korea had not developed a missile technology capacity that constituted a deterrent? I mean, I want to ask about that because for the last 5 years, as I've been in discussions with other people who are even progressive anti-war people, people who favor Korean reunification, people always, not all people, but some people would always make the argument, why is North Korea so belligerent? Why are they so bellicose? Why is North Korea just steadfastly going forward? Maybe the North Korean calculations on this were correct, not because they wanted war with the United States. Obviously, they don't. But up until now, no U.S. head of state has gone to meet, except Jimmy Carter, who was then retired, to meet the head of state of North Korea.
Exactly. I mean, so just to respond to some of the points that you raised, Donald Trump, in agreeing to a summit with North Korea, which, as you mentioned, is absolutely unprecedented, is essentially recognizing North Korea, which the United States historically has not done. And the other thing that you mentioned is that the fact that North Korea not only was on the nuclear path, North Korea has been on the nuclear path for a number of years. It assiduously took to this path during the George W. Bush Axis of Evil time, continued on this path through the Barack Obama strategic patience era, and then during the Trump administration demonstrated in theory nuclear strike capability against the United States, mainland United States. And in so doing, it was actually North Korea that changed the game. And the strategic calculus totally has shifted. And as perverse and ironic as this may sound to some people, it was North Korea's possession of the bomb, so to speak, that has enabled this discussion of peace. North Korea would not have, even though, yes, it's absolutely crucial that we have Moon Jae-in in office versus Park Geun-hye, this total hawk. She's now in prison for over 2 decades. That was actually very crucial. But that alone would not have been sufficient to actually have North Korea entertain the possibility of peace. And so what we have right now with Donald Trump is we have someone who was, and I would say this, with all of his threats of totally destroying North Korea at the United Nations, as you mentioned, he was basically, and human rights experts were present in that audience, he was a would-be genocidaire. He wanted to possibly commit genocide. And we also have this sort of very odd possibility in our moment that the would-be genocidaire is talking the language of peace. And so we have to recall, like you said, the language that Donald Trump is using is incredibly paternalistic. There's more than a whiff of imperialism there. It's extraordinarily imperious to say that he gives his blessing. But, you know, the fact of the matter is if you look at the 1953 Armistice Agreement, it's specified that all foreign powers have to withdraw their military forces from the Korean Peninsula within a reasonable amount of time. We should recall that China withdrew all of its forces within approximately half a decade's time. The Armistice Agreement also stipulated that no new weaponry could be introduced onto the Korean Peninsula. Now, if we look at the U.S. role on the Korean Peninsula and the fact that structurally South Korea has been positioned as a junior partner, we have to understand the United States has effectively militarily occupied the southern part of the peninsula going back several decades. The United States maintained approximately 30,000 U.S. military forces on the Korean Peninsula. It operates in approximately 80 military installations. According to a series of joint sort of security documents, these, you know, the SOFA, the Status of Forces Agreement, mutual security documents with South Korea, the United States at whim and at will can use any South Korean military installation. So it gives the lie in all of these different ways to South Korean sovereignty. Moreover, in times of heightened warfare, it is the United States that has command control over South Korean military forces. So, of course, the Armistice Agreement also stipulated that within 3 months' time, the major signatories to the agreement, China, North Korea, and the United States, needed to return to the peace table and hammer out a permanent peace agreement. And so belatedly, we're having a discussion of the possibility of peace, but that possibility of peace structurally comes with major concessions from the United States. It's hard to imagine this administration being willing to entertain all of that. Donald Trump, after all, has come in as a war merchant. He has a businessman's relationship to the military-industrial complex. He has made reallocated the national budget, taken away from social spending, and put it toward war. And so we've seen him step into the tried and true true role of U.S. president relative to the war machine. He's basically been a warmonger. And, you know, the question is, can a warmonger broker peace with North Korea? And, you know, I think that we should also recall that North Korea has in recent days leveled a critique against the United States. Now, very few media sources paid any attention to this. But the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute released a major study in late March and indicated, no surprise, that the United States is, in Martin Luther King Jr.'s words, the greatest purveyor of violence around the world. And it accounts for 34, they didn't use those terms, that's me injecting that in there, but the United States accounts for 34% of the world's weapon sales.
I saw that study.
Yeah, and that increased by 25% just from Barack Obama's second term to the Trump first term. And the KCNA, which is North Korea's international media organ, described the United States as, quote, the top world's top-class war merchant that spawns war and massacre in different parts of the world through large-scale arms sales, going against the desire of mankind for peace and stability. And it concluded that the warmonger is not in a position to talk about peace. So I'm not saying that peace isn't a possibility, but there's a structural problem when it comes to the United States, its geostrategic interests within the Asia-Pacific region, and its militarized infrastructure that amounts to a forward-deployed permanent warfare posture.
Those are excellent points. Simone Chun, that was the voice of Dr. Christine Hong. She's the Associate Professor of Critical Race and Ethnic Studies at UC Santa Cruz. We're also speaking with Simone Chun. Professor Chun is a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korean Peace Network. Simone, there's another structural issue, which has to do with the economic sanctions. I mean, they're so draconian. They're U.S. economic sanctions and also U.N. Security Council economic sanctions that really can't be undone because the U.S. can veto any resolution to undo them. That would make it seemingly impossible and even illegal for South Korean economic interests to be doing business with North Korea. And of course, economic intercourse between the two Koreas would be a vital sort of, as you mentioned, step-by-step approach, part of the process. Do the economic sanctions also constitute whatever happens in diplomacy and at meetings, an enduring structural obstacle to some a peace resolution?
Yes, indeed. I think that we have, for many months, we have talked about the devastating consequence of economic sanction on people in North Korea. You know, economic sanction is really a form of a silent genocide against the North Korean people who have nothing to do with the regime's brutality or, you know, any other. And so this is actually, I think, is a new raising point, which is a very also relevant in also latest this news about North and South Korea. Summit meeting will have a political declaration on ending a Korean War or ending the hostilities. Now, as Christine pointed out very well, you know, there's a very, very, very difficult structural hindrance obstacle in the creating peace in Korea, specifically for the United States' role there. Now, that has been, so it has been very difficult for two Koreas, whether it's economic or political engagement, it has always been very difficult. So what they're trying to do right now is that they are attempting to separate two issues. What are the two issues? Creating a peace or the permanent peace regime on the Korean Peninsula. And the other issue is the one that the United States most interested, right? Denuclearization of North Korea. Now, so far what happened was because we focused so much on denuclearization of North Korea, any inter-Korean engagement has not been really successful. So by declaring ending the Korean War, by declaring both North and South Korea agreeing ending hostility, right? They're not going to attack. They're not either conventional nuclear weapon. What they're trying to say is that now, no matter what happened between the United States or other superpowers, the two Koreas are going to create a permanent system, cooperation system that does not change, you know, depending on the kind of administration. So that is what I think they're, in my view, they're trying to do, create, in a way to separate the two issues. And so that will allow more room, flexibility with regard to economic or humanitarian interaction between two Korea. And moreover, even under the UN, this harshest, really, you know, harshest unprecedented sanction on this tiny nation, there are several hundred way that two Koreas can engage in a humanitarian, economic, social basis. So I think that is one thing that the significance of the latest the news about ending the Korean War. And one more thing I want to mention that is that something that we don't really hear so much about it. This peace process, you know, yes, Donald Trump has a great, you know, he played his role to Korea's Moon Jae-in and Kim Jong-un, etc. But what something very, very new here in this process, and I have never seen it before, that is enormous public energy. You know, Korean government just created a website about Inter-Korea Summit. This energy and passion, and there's, you know, YouTube and children, Korean children are making statements how they would like to live in a unified Korea. And business people are talking about, hey, let's open up, you know, let's revive the Kaesong Industrial Park. And here in the United States, and I'm just a It really just it's amazing with all the rhetoric about Donald Trump, right, bellicose rhetoric, consistently close to 60, 70, right now, more than 85%, even Republicans support the North Korea and the United States the summit. And I think this is a whole new paradigm of making peace. So I think that's probably we should really stress and keep doing that.
Okay, we have about a minute left. Christine Hong, I want to give you the final word. That's important what Simone is saying about the energy of the people in South Korea, undoubtedly matched by energy of people in North Korea, overseas Koreans. It really could have a palpable impact on the political outcome because, of course, if the people were asleep or passive, if they were just spectators, not involved, if it was just between the elites, maybe nothing happens, but as a consequence of all of this energy and enthusiasm, and because people really do want peace, and they want an enduring peace, and they want to be able to see their relatives, all of that could become a factor in this. Anyway, I took up half your minute, 30 seconds left.
That's okay. You know, I would just say that, you know, along the lines of what Simone is saying, you know, there's a tremendous sort of upswell that you see on the Korean Peninsula, both North and South. It's a sort of moment of incredible hope. And the fact of the matter is, as we talk about Moon Jae-in, we talk about these sort of isolated leader figures. But the fact of the matter is Moon Jae-in was deputized by the South Korean people who ousted his very neoconservative, hawkish predecessor who did not engage with North Korea. And he has been deputized in a kind of democratizing way from below to actually engage and to work out a permanent peace with North Korea. And in this regard, this represents a difference from the kind of wave of right-wing populism that we're seeing elsewhere. This is actually a sort of democratizing move for peace. And I also want to end on one point, and this is to quote Georgi Tolaria of 38 North. And he was saying that when we talk about denuclearization, we have to understand that North Korea's conception of denuclearization is that it is a global concept and that Pyongyang will relinquish its nuclear weapons in the context of complete and general nuclear disarmament.
Good words. We've been joined from Santa Cruz, California, by Dr. Christine Hong, Associate Professor of Critical Race and Ethnic Studies at UC Santa Cruz. She's a member of the Korea Policy Institute. And we've been joined from Seattle by Simone Chun. Simone Chun is a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korea Peace Network. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm Nicole Roussel, sitting in for John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our regular segment. It happens every Wednesday. We look at nuclear issues, including nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, nuclear waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States with one of the country's foremost experts. We're joined once again this week by Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. You can see his works and the work of the organization at beyondnuclear.org. Kevin Camps, welcome back.
Thanks, Brian and Nicole. Glad to be here.
Thank you for joining. You're not here in the studio. The sun is shining. The skies are blue. It's a little bit warmer. But you're in some, I don't know, you're under snow.
I am in the winter wonderland of Michigan.
Why? Why are you there?
Well, this is home. My mom is here, and we just got her back from Florida up here for the supposed warm weather months, but that's not happening yet.
Yeah. I mean, we're having extreme weather in the upper Midwest and in the East, big tornadoes in North Carolina. I mean, these were record snowfalls in Wisconsin, record snowfalls in, a lot of snow in Minnesota. Again, you know, it's all related, Kevin, because there's lots of discussion and debate about why we're having extreme weather events. And of course, there are some, especially those in the nuclear industry, who will argue nuclear is the alternative to fossil fuels. In other words, instead of emitting carbons that have created dynamic climate change, maybe nuclear energy, in spite of all of its problems and difficulties and dangers, constitutes something of an alternative, given the big picture and the dangers, the existential dangers posed by global warming. Anyway, when you're up in Michigan where it's snowing on April 18th, what's your thought about that?
You know, the first thing to say is nuclear power is too expensive and takes too long to be a climate solution. So it's a non-starter. But I have to add that extreme weather is a huge risk to nuclear power. So just one example would be the Pilgrim atomic reactor near Boston, which we pray will be closed in the near future before the worst happens. They have had so many close calls just in recent years because of severe winter weather. And luckily, the worst did not happen, but that reactor did have to shut down. So what's really incredible is when the nuclear power PR says, hey, we're great at solving the climate crisis and we're dependable in extreme weather like bad blizzards or polar vortexes, it's not true. There have been countless shutdowns during extreme weather events because nuclear power is too risky to be operating during tornado conditions or severe blizzards on the Boston shore. So it's just not true.
Wow, I'm glad you mentioned that because people don't think about it that way, but they should. They should think about it. Shinzo Abe is in Mar-a-Lago, Nicole. He's talking to Donald Trump. His own status as the leader of Japan is a little bit up in the air right now, scandals plaguing him. And of course, Donald Trump, he's visited with Donald Trump more than any other head of state since Donald Trump became president. But Donald Trump is kind of just slapping him around, including not waiving, not yet at least, the tariffs on steel and aluminum that have been applied or been given. All the other waivers been given to America's allies, but not to Japan for some reason. So Abe might go. And if Abe goes, perhaps the issue of Fukushima will also come back to the fore in a kind of different way. Because, again, Fukushima, and we're going to remind the audience also, as Kevin is reminding us, the consequence of an extreme weather event.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great point. And we know Kevin has talked about this before, but Shinzo Abe has absolutely downplayed and even in some ways covered up some of this really serious ongoing situation that's going on in Fukushima. Kevin, do you want to tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, Shinzo Abe had just come back to power. He had previously served as a prime minister, but the Democratic Party of Japan took power for just a few years. Other than that, the Liberal Democratic Party of Japan, Abe's party, goes back all the way to 1955. They have ruled Japan for, I would say, over 95% of the country's history since 1955. They're a pro-nuclear power party, unfortunately. It goes all the way back to then. And Shinzo Abe came back to power in 2012, a year after the Fukushima nuclear catastrophe had started. And one of the very first things he did was lie to the international community, the International Olympic Committee. He said, everything is under control at Fukushima Daiichi. And it was an absolute lie. Things are not under control there now, you know. They've gotten somewhat of a lid on some of the problems, but they've still got daily releases to the Pacific Ocean. And he did that so that Tokyo would win the Summer Olympics of 2020. And they did. And so now there's going to be this major international event with millions of visitors coming to Japan, to the immediate area of Fukushima Daiichi. They're actually going to hold Olympic events up there. So I guess even if Abe is forced from power because of this financial scandal he's facing, the next prime minister of Japan, of whichever party, either tells the truth about what's going on at Fukushima Daiichi now or continues the lie. And I guess we'll see what happens.
Again, we're talking about extreme weather events and how nuclear power plants cannot or will not be able to withstand many of them. In the case of Fukushima, again, for those who don't remember, this happened as a consequence of an earthquake in Japan on March 11th, 2011. So just about 7 years ago, last month. And immediately after the earthquake, there was a tsunami. The tsunami crashed into the area around Fukushima reactors. And the active reactors automatically shut down their sustained fission reactions. However, the tsunami, Kevin, disabled all the emergency generators. So even though if there's a plan B and a plan C, a plan D, I mean, ultimately, there has to be the end of all that contingency planning. But everything can go wrong. And you know, like when we think back about Three Mile Island and the movies that were made about it in popular culture, it's always described as a perfect storm, like one of those unusual set of circumstances where all the stars align for catastrophe and disaster. And they all have to align at a particular moment, meaning that they are so rare as to be, you know, negligible in terms of statistical probability. But it's actually not that uncommon.
Yeah. Some recent news of just the last few days in the Japanese press, there is a Tokyo Electric worker who is now testifying publicly that a senior executive at Tokyo Electric quashed plans to build an adequate or a better seawall. There was a woefully inadequate seawall built at Fukushima Daiichi, kind of a token effort. But there had been a much more significant effort proposed. It was decided to do it because of the real risks along that coast, and a senior executive simply quashed it, and the rest is history. So, you know, the earthquake took out the electricity grid. The tsunami took out the emergency diesel generators. They were in station blackout. They couldn't run the safety systems, the cooling systems. But the thing is, you know, the U.S. nuclear power industry, its PR campaigns try to say, oh, you know, you can't have an earthquake in Michigan. You can't have a tsunami in Michigan. That's not true, actually. Both of those statements are not true. But what is more of a risk, more probable here in Michigan, for example, is severe weather, severe winter weather that could take down the grid, the electricity grid. And then the emergency diesels are your last line of defense to cool an atomic reactor that is hellishly hot. And they have a horrendous record in the U.S. nuclear power industry of emergency diesel generators simply failing to work when called upon. And an example right from Michigan, the Fermi Unit 2 nuclear plant here in southeastern Michigan had 20 years of emergency diesel generator dysfunction that they didn't even recognize. They were doing regular tests. The tests were faulty. And they finally realized that if they had called upon those emergency diesels at any point during those 20 years, they would have been quickly overwhelmed and would have failed. So yet again, saved by a guardian angel or sheer luck, however you want to look at it, that they never had to call on those diesels.
It's not likely that there may be an earthquake in Michigan. Okay, perhaps, perhaps not. But it's very likely that there will be earthquakes in California. And in fact, there was an earthquake in California just in early April. I'm looking at the LA Times, largest earthquake in several years shakes Southern California, causing landslides on Santa Cruz Island. This was April 6th of this year. That would be, well,
12 days ago.
12 days ago. What's the danger for California with earthquakes and nuclear power?
Well, the good news is that most of the reactors in California have been shut down. June of 2013, two reactors in Southern California called San Onofre Units 2 and 3 were shut down because of major safety risks having to do with defective steam generators, which are a pathway to meltdown. They had they called it a small radioactivity release a year earlier because of a tube blowing. And luckily, there was not a cascading failure of tubes. That's the pathway to core meltdown. And it led to permanent shutdown at two reactors. So all that's left in California now in terms of operating reactors is Diablo Canyon, Units 1 and 2, which are in San Luis Obispo. The bad news is they're still operating, and the company may keep operating them until 2024 and 2025, which is when the 40-year licenses expire on those reactors. That's several more years of these earthquake risks. And incredibly, there are earthquake fault lines within hundreds of yards of that nuclear power plant, which were just discovered a few years ago. And if you go further out, you've got the San Andreas Fault. It is surrounded by earthquake fault lines. So that's, several more long years of earthquake risks at San Onofre. At Diablo Canyon. The lingering risk, even at San Onofre and some of the other shutdown nukes in California, like in Sacramento, up north at Humboldt Bay, is the high-level radioactive waste that's still there. Some of it is still in storage pools, which are very vulnerable to earthquakes. But even the dry cast storage, although it's safer than the pools, it's still not safe. And incredibly, at San Onofre, just to show the irresponsibility and the risk-taking of the companies involved, and even the government agencies are supposed to represent the public in these decisions, they are putting the waste within just hundreds of feet of the Pacific Ocean at San Onofre. They're moving it closer to the ocean than it already is, when they could easily just move it a few miles inland onto a Marine Corps base, Camp Pendleton, to higher elevation, out of the tsunami zone, away from earthquake fault lines, safeguard and secure it, with the added bonus of thousands of U.S. Marines to help guard it against a terrorist attack, for example. But no, they're not doing that. They're putting it right on the coast of the Pacific Ocean.
That's insane. We are currently talking with Kevin Camps, the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. This is Nicole Roussel here with Brian Becker on Loud and Clear. Brian, last week on this regular segment that we do with Kevin, we were talking a little bit about the opposition to this proposed radioactive waste dump in New Mexico.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big story. I didn't know about it until we talked to Kevin. Obviously, people in New Mexico know about it because, I mean, it's poisoning their state. It's poisoning their communities. It's poisoning their backyards. Maybe it's poisoning their children, and not for a few years, but for, well, I wouldn't even say generations, perhaps centuries. I don't know. But opposition is growing. Talk about what the issue is again, Kevin. Let's just reframe it. And also the increase, which we would expect, and we want to promote the opposition to these kind of reckless plans to make New Mexico just a big toxic radioactive waste dump.
Yeah, that's how they've been treated for a long time. I mean, starting with Los Alamos in 1943, they have been treated as a nuclear colony, as my colleague Leona Morgan with the Nuclear Issues Study Group in Albuquerque has put it. She is Diné, more commonly known as Navajo, herself, and they've suffered a lot on the Navajo lands from uranium mining and the aftermath of that, and that goes decades back out there too. So what this proposal is called a centralized interim storage facility for highly radioactive irradiated nuclear fuel from commercial reactors across the country. And folks should realize that 90% of the commercial reactors in this country are in the eastern half of the country, and 75% are east of the Mississippi River. So if this Holtec International, that's the company, and then the counties involved are the Eddie Lee Counties Energy Alliance, if this scheme goes forward, they would move all of the waste in the country and all of the waste yet to be made in this country to southeastern New Mexico on the border with Texas. We're talking 120,000 metric tons, which is, right now, there's 80,000 metric tons in the United States. So they're planning ahead. They're going to accommodate what's going to be made in decades to come. And they would park it out there, but it could become de facto permanent. They're admitting to, well, it'll probably be here for 40 years. Well, maybe it'll be here for 120 years, which was just pointed out by my colleagues out there. That's older than New Mexico's been a state. They were only formed in, I think, 1912 or something like that. So that's long term. That's not temporary. But the truth be told, it could become de facto permanent, because once it's there, it'll be in a single congressional district. And if that U.S. representative in the future wants to get it out, wants to move it someplace else, like to a permanent repository, deep geologic disposal, well, that representative would be up against 434 others who think that, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Why not just keep it where it's at?
Yeah, we're talking with Kevin Camps, as we do every Wednesday, about the issues related to nuclear energy, nuclear technology, nuclear power. Its impact on the United States, its impact on society in general, and of course, the future and where we can go and what we can do differently to mitigate or to eliminate eventually the risks, the dangers, the fallout, the waste from the nuclear industry. Kevin, one of the issues that we've been following week after week in this segment, and you've been following it beyond nuclear, is the whole struggle whereby the industry is pushing back against the closing of nuclear reactors in Ohio and Pennsylvania. Again, let's review where we are right now. And I'm just looking at some of the news where the industry is really sort of suggesting that if we close down these five nuclear units in Ohio and Pennsylvania, the sky will fall. And as a consequence, they're looking for what?
Well, if First Energy gets its proposed bailout, we're talking $8 billion per year, because it's not just the four atomic reactors that it has announced closure dates for in the not-too-distant future. It is 80 plants, both coal and nuclear, throughout the PJM grid, which stretches from the Mid-Atlantic all the way to Illinois. So 80 nuclear and coal plants bailed out for $8 billion per year, and that's going to be at public expense. That's their proposal, and they're really throwing spaghetti against the wall at this point to see what will stick. They've appealed to the Energy Secretary, Rick Perry, for an emergency bailout under an obscure subsection of the Federal Power Act, usually reserved for wartime emergencies or natural disasters. And the only disaster here is the business decisions of First Energy itself, investing in these obsolete technologies. And another new development is that the chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which regulates the grids, ultimately, a Trump appointee named Kevin McIntyre, has now said he thinks that sounds like a good idea. So you've got Rick Perry at Energy, you've got Kevin McIntyre at FERC, you've got Trump dining with top lobbyists from First Energy thinking this really deserves a good look-see. So it's pretty scary. I mean, there are challenges being put forth by groups like the Sierra Club saying that if you do this, we're going to challenge it in court. This is so absurd what you're proposing. So it's not like folks are taking this sitting down, not at all. The competitors of First Energy are speaking up very loudly, from the natural gas industry to the renewables industry to manufacturers, major manufacturers that use a lot of electricity. They're going to be asked to pay this bill, as well as households, consumer protection groups, environmental groups. There is such a broad coalition fighting this thing. But it just shows the power of the nuclear and coal lobbies, especially now under Trump, that they even would consider such extreme measures.
You've even got, you know, trade associations, some even right-wing think tanks like the Heritage Foundation and Arstrid Institute. You've got the PJM report itself saying that, you know, this is totally unnecessary. This is all for emergency reserves, not for the actual amount of energy that they need in that region. And PJM recently started talking about how the cold snap we've had over the past couple of years and the performance of the grid in that area goes to show just how fine we would be. That performance has gone great.
And for our audience, what the heck is PJM?
So that's the region that we're talking about where all of this energy, where they're trying to kind of even out this energy.
Pennsylvania, Jersey.
Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Maryland, PJM. But it has expanded over time all the way west and goes way down south to parts of North Carolina. So it's 13 states plus the District of Columbia, and it's the single biggest electric grid in the country. So if they do set this precedent, guess what? There are troubled nuclear and coal plants elsewhere in the country, too. And unfortunately, just yesterday, I think, the head of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, under Trump, a Trump appointee, has said, sounds like a good idea to him, which is unfortunate because earlier this year, FERC took a more responsible position and said an earlier pitch from the Department of Energy along very similar lines did not hold water. So things are shifting at FERC, and we're going to have to pull out all the stops and just stop this thing. And that's going to be from street-level protests and letters to the editor across the country to FERC's front door and then probably the courtroom at some point.
Yeah, before we go to the issue of nuclear weapons, Kevin, just real quick, I'm looking at a news release from the Brattle Group. Not Battle Group, but Brattle Group. battle with an R. The closure of five nuclear units in Ohio and Pennsylvania owned and operated by First Energy Nuclear Operating Company and one operated in Pennsylvania by Exelon Generation would have an adverse impact on the environment and economy of those states, according to an industry-sponsored analysis, the Brattle Group. What's the Brattle Group? I mean, we have all these think tanks, and people might think, well, you know, they're like independent investigators, but obviously somebody's financing them.
The best economic analysis money can buy. The nuclear industry hires the Brattle Group to churn out these reports. They've done it around the country. Now they're doing it again, not for the first time in a place like Ohio. What's interesting, if they name five reactors, you know, there are only four being discussed until this. The one they're adding is Three Mile Island Unit 1. And you'd think that after Three Mile Island Unit 2 had a 50% meltdown on March 28, 1979, that they might be a little more careful about lumping it in, but that's what they're doing. They want to bail out Beaver Valley Units 1 and 2, northwest of Pittsburgh. Now apparently Three Mile Island Unit 1 still operating, Exelon's plant near Harrisburg, and plus the Northern Ohio nukes, Davis-Bessey and Perry on Lake Erie. The thing I'd like to point out, they're talking about jobs, they're talking about tax revenues. Well, let's look at Davis-Bessey, which has a severely cracked containment. The concrete shield building, the last line of defense against a major catastrophic radioactivity release in the event of a meltdown, and Davis-Bessey has had several close calls with meltdowns over the decades. That containment is not going to hold. It's going to fail. It's going to release the radioactivity into the environment. And how did it get so severely cracked? The blizzard of 1978 cracked that concrete structure. And to this day, here we are yet again with freeze-thaw cycles happening in this neck of the woods, Davis-Bessey included. Every time they have a freeze-thaw cycle at Davis-Bessey, the cracking worsens by a half inch or more. So there's the possibility that that structure is just going to fall of its own weight at some point, and it could initiate a meltdown. There are safety systems below that containment building that could be taken out by falling concrete just because of the cracking doing its thing over time, and that would initiate the meltdown that the failed containment could then not hold in.
And this is even more likely as we move forward with this, you know, these extreme weather events that we've been seeing over the past couple of years and even decades that are only getting much, much worse as you see snow here in late April.
If the worst happens at Davis-Bessey, to contradict the Brattle Group's report, you would take out the entire region. It would be an uninhabitable zone. That would be kind of bad for the economy, I think, and bad for jobs.
I think. And for people, probably, too.
Taking out a time zone, turning time zones into dead zones. That's what the nuclear power industry is capable of.
Turning to the other side of this coin, turning to the nuclear weapons side of this, Kevin, you sent over a really interesting and fascinating campaign that's been started called Back from the Brink. It calls on the U.S. to declare that it will never use nuclear weapons first, which, you know, given our kind of massive reputation in the world, seems like something that we could probably handle. It also demands that the U.S. take its nuclear weapons off hair trigger alert and the unchecked authority of any president to launch nuclear war, and abandons plans to spend $1.7 trillion enhancing our nuclear forces. This is obviously all money that could be used, for example, for green energy or for jobs or for education or for any of the other things that we need in this country. Tell us a little bit more about this campaign.
Well, it was launched this year by some likely suspects like Physicians for Social Responsibility, which has won two Nobel Peace Prizes, 1985 and then 2017, as part of the international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons. And they've attracted a lot of endorsing groups. We are one of probably hundreds at this point that have endorsed this Back from the Brink. And, you know, it's just common sense ideas. And in fact, the Obama administration had taken a major step towards no first use policies, which Trump has now reversed in the Nuclear Posture Review that came out early this year. Unfortunately, even the Obama administration had taken some bad steps, like that $1.7 trillion nuclear renovation project, if you include inflation, over a 30-year period. So Trump is just accelerating that and making it worse in ways such as usable nuclear weapons, small nuclear weapons, tactical nuclear weapons, which again, the Obama administration was taking a step away from. Trump is taking a major step in the direction of. So a lot of this has gotten worse under Trump. Of course, the hot zones in the world, from North Korea to Syria to Iran, are just making these matters much more serious. And we're really trying to revive a decades-old anti-nuclear weapons movement that goes all the way back to the beginning, really. You had Women's Strike for Peace in the 1950s, which were calling attention to the threats of fallout from the atmospheric testing going on by the U.S., by the Soviet Union. And in a short order of years, they got that stopped, thankfully. And the testing went underground, which was not good either, because a lot of those leaked. They certainly poisoned the places where the underground tests took place, but a third of the underground tests leaked to the atmosphere. But still, Women's Strike for Peace, Barry Commoner in St. Louis, the biologist, Dr. Spock, the pediatrician, they got this stuff done in a short period of time, you know? So that's the kind of national, international movement we need again.
Kevin Camps is our guest. He's with Beyond Nuclear. Go to the website, beyondnuclear.org, to read Kevin's writings and find out about that organization and how you can support them and how you can become involved with them. We have 2 minutes left, Kevin. I want to stay with the issue of nuclear weapons. We know that Mike Pompeo, now we know, had met secretly with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in North Korea in preparation for a possible summit between Donald Trump and the North Korean leadership. Of course, the issue of nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula is on the agenda. The North Korean position, interestingly, is that they want the United States to also guarantee that there won't be any nuclear weapons in or around the Korean Peninsula because, of course, the United States was the one in 1958 who first introduced nuclear weapons into the Korean Peninsula. We'll see how all of that plays out. But I want to ask you real quick, Pompeo seems to be, and John Bolton, the new National Security Council, want to rip up the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran nuclear arms deal. How do you rip that deal up and then go and negotiate with North Korea and say, hey, give up your nuclear weapons? We're operating in good faith here. Go ahead. 1 minute left.
Exactly. Well, Pompeo, during his confirmation hearing for Secretary of State just last week, said he could envision a ground invasion of North Korea. So how's that going to play?
I get it. Give up your nuclear weapons and then we will invade you. I kind of like the same message they gave to Saddam Hussein, say, in 2003.
And Muammar Gaddafi. And that's what prompted North Korea to develop nuclear weapons were those two ground invasions, I guess you could say, and the executions of the leaders of those countries. So, you know, that's North Korea's position is we're defending ourselves. It's the Kim family defending its regime against U.S. military intervention. So that's where we find ourselves. You got Bolton, you got Pompeo, you got Trump hawkish on North Korea. What are they building to here? Bolton would say, hey, we tried diplomacy, the meeting failed, I guess all that's left is war.
Perhaps. We're gonna talk about that next week again, Kevin. We're out of time this week. We've been joined by Kevin Camps. He's the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. Kevin joins us every Wednesday. Come to our show every Wednesday to hear Kevin talk about nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, nuclear waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.